Matt, I ask you to come introduce Stan and Mike, and we'll begin. Matt?
So I'm told that in 1999, the first gathering of the Ecclesia Project occurred just down the road from here. There were about 12 people at that gathering, and two of those founding members were Mike Buddy and Stan Hauerwas. 3 years after that, oh, by the way, that founding moment, the document that was produced from that can be found in your folders. It's called Declaration and Invitation, 1999. For those of you who haven't gotten a chance to explore that, I would say take a look at that. It will help put some flesh on what the Ecclesia Project is all about. 2002, 3 years later, Stanley Hauerwas and Enda McDonough met to pen the appeal for the abolition of war. And that is this bright green sheet that's in your folder. Please also take a look at that. That's serving as one of our core documents for this weekend. Now, 14 years since the founding of the Ecclesia Project, Mike and Stan are here to discuss the merits, the challenges, the possibilities associated with this appeal to the abolition of war. And I should probably reiterate, for the sake of those who weren't here yesterday, what Brent said about our plenary sessions. When we decided, when the planning team decided to call this meeting Practicing the Peace of Christ, we wanted to draw attention to the way that our various practices here, worship, gathering, eating, perhaps drinking, singing, laughing, how these are constitutive of the peace of Christ. And also how what we do in plenary sessions and workshops are themselves performances of the peace of Christ. Not simply talk about, but are themselves constitutive of the peace of Christ. And to that end, we wanted to make sure that all the plenary sessions were constituted by pairs this weekend, and to the best of our ability that there would be a Roman Catholic and a Protestant presenting together. Now, my hunch is that Hauerwas probably bristles at being labeled a Protestant in that group. But he'll probably forgive us too. So I'd like to invite Mike and Stan up to discuss the abolition of war.
I thought I might begin by saying a bit about Enda. Enda is a Roman Catholic moral theologian who taught many years at St. Patrick's in Maynooth, Ireland. He, as a Catholic moral theologian, he represented and has represented a more liberal side of Catholicism in Ireland, but is Irish Catholic all the way down. He taught at Notre Dame for a number of years, where we became close friends. When Paul and I went to Ireland, which we do fairly often on vacation, we go by and see Enda, and when you go to his rooms in at St. Patrick's, you have to be ready to drink a lot of Jameson's. And and one time he just retired, he's now in his 80s. He said, "I'm so glad you're here." He said, "I've been thinking about a project I would like to involve you in. Though I've always been identified publicly as a just warrior, I've always thought pacifism is the really only viable moral alternative. And where slavery was a century ago thought to be morally problematic by many, it was still nonetheless accepted as a given. But now no one, though we still have slavery, it's called wage labor, no one now thinks slavery can be justified. And he said, I would like to enact that about war. And I'd like you to join me in calling for an abolition of war. So I said, well, I think I can do that, Enda. And I didn't notice at the time that he didn't get my hesitation, why I only thought I could do it. Then after we drafted it, and then I wrote for his Festschrift, a tribute to Enda McDonough, and in it I suggested that one of the difficulties for a Christological pacifist such as myself is presumption that to call for the abolition of war as a general stance for the world to take can underwrite a Constantinian presumption that the world has the resources to deny war. So when I say something like, Christians are called to nonviolence not because we believe that nonviolence is a strategy to rid the world of war, but rather in a world of war, as faithful followers of Christ, we cannot imagine anything other than being nonviolent. And that may make the world more violent because the world does not want the order it calls peace called into question as the violence that it is. So the very fact that you think you can call for the abolition of war can underwrite the presumption that you don't live eschatologically in two times, and that the world that the Christians live in is not the same world that those who are not Christian live in. It is the same world, but they don't know it. Now, once I wrote that, the tribute to Enda, and made that articulate, Enda said, that's the first time I understood why pastors might have a problem with general presumptions that nonviolence is a possibility as a general stance for anyone. And while you use whatever arguments you can, and many of them are pragmatic, to hopefully make war less likely, if the reason that war, you call for the abolition of war, is not because you think war can be abolished, but because you think it has been in Christ's cross, war has been abolished. But then that means your stance in the world, it oftentimes needs to be made articulate in terms of its differences between those that just think war is such a horrible business, we can't imagine why anyone continues to engage in it. Now, part of what that does then is give you a conceptual challenge that I try to develop. Namely, how do you know what war is? How do you know what war is? I mean, people will say, oftentimes they'll look at a war that looks like it's going to break out, and they'll say, well, looks like, more good than evil. We can fight it in a fairly discriminating manner. We are going to give terms for surrender and so on. 3 out of 6 ain't bad. We'll still call it war. Challenge is, for just war thinkers, is if a war is not just, what is it? If a war is not just, what is it? and it must satisfy all the conditions if it is to be just. Why don't we call it World Slaughter 1? Why don't we call it World Slaughter 2? The very fact that you continue to use war as a generalized description that says, well, it may not be just, but you still have to do it, is part of the kind of challenge that the abolition of war is trying to enlist. And that puts you, therefore, I mean, what you constantly have to do is to remind yourself and remind those who you're entering into coalition with who don't share your eschatological presumptions, that you as a Christian find yourself able to say the kinds of things you're able to say about the abolition of war on determinative, Christological, eschatological grounds that your ally and your opponent may not share. And that is part of what I take to be the challenge of the call for the abolition of war.
We intend this as a conversation, and to that end, we're not entirely sure what we're going to touch on here. We'll open up for comments and questions from the floor later. One thing that is probably worth noting as we use the Stanley's statement on the abolition of war as a starting off point, we need not be limited to that. There's a whole session that he and Matt are doing later this morning to go into even more detail on that. I have to be honest and admit to you that the first time I heard that Stanley had issued a call for the abolition of war, my first reaction was, oh no, this is the dumbest idea I have ever heard. What immediately came to mind to me, which will give you an indication of the depth of geek that I reside in, was that this sounds exactly like the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928, in which the major European powers signed an international agreement calling for the abolition of warfare, that it was henceforth illegal and illegitimate as a way to solve international disputes. The U.S. negotiator for that treaty was Frank Kellogg, who later won the Nobel Peace Prize as a result. And I think if I ever get some student workers who want to have a project, I'd love to do a study of Nobel Peace Prize winners who maybe should be up on war crimes charges generally, but that would be a different matter. What Stanley's document and invitation initiated, however, are some interesting and healthy and creative conversations about war, about peace, about the bedrock categories we use to order our descriptions of the world, much less talk about what's right and wrong about them. And our session today is an outgrowth of that fruitful conversation over a period of many years, and there are many more years of it yet to come. So the idea that, in fact, if war is not just, it needs to be recategorized and inhabit an existentially different place in our world, I take as an invitation to do creative work that is, in many ways, much more difficult than it sounds. Not simply at the conceptual level, but in fact at the level of practice, at the level of witness, of church practice, a whole range of things that once you start to unravel that cloth, you find that the threads go in a variety of different directions simultaneously. I'm not sure what my job is up here other than to be the straight man for Stanley. I feel like the low-rent version of Ed McMahon all of a sudden. So for lack of a better place to start, do you want to talk a little bit more, Stanley, about what abolition means to you as a way forward for us to think? If we if we think about war as itself a category under suspicion now, what would its abolition look like?
I think the session at the beginning, plenary session yesterday, what we heard in Randy and Yana was a reconceptualization of peace. They talked about very everyday events as a way of displaying what peace might look like in terms of whether you could use this room in the church for our early childhood formation. We normally don't think about those kinds of events as issues of involving peace. And what I think we need to do is to think about it's very easy to write the history of war. Well, I suppose that may be an overstatement, but at least if you remember how you were introduced into the history of the United States in high school, you remember it's the history of the wars very much. I think we need to know how to tell our stories as stories that locate fundamental peaceable activity that we haven't called peace, but called the priest said we would do this. So how to imaginatively retell our stories. I mean, and there I take what Nugent did with the Old Testament to be extremely important, because exactly what you get in the Old Testament, which is oftentimes used to say, well, God said, go kill the Amalekites. And, you know, my response is always, if God said, go kill the Amalekites to you, go do it, if you can find them. I mean, you know, if you're supposed to invade Cana, go do it if you can find Cana. What the Old Testament, I think, helps us see is how Israel slowly learned to name her mistaken views that she could survive with a king and with an army over her life rather than survive as a people of holiness determined by the worship of God. And of course it took centuries to discover that and to develop that literature in that way. But I think that that is an extraordinary moral and intellectual challenge for us to reclaim. How it is that peace is a more determinative reality than violence. I mean, for example, if you take the 89 revolution, 89 was an extraordinary event. And what finally seemed to be the turning point? Well, it just seemed to be that in Hungary and Czechoslovakia at the time, people simply decided that they couldn't live by the lie anymore. And they said, well, there are some of these reform pastors, and here, let it be noted, I said something nice about the reform. Here are these reform pastors who don't lie. Let's see if we can do some business with them. I think how you can retell that story in a way that shows that allegedly it wasn't American nuclear policies that ended the Soviet Union. It was people that didn't lie. And people that don't lie is one of the ways that you begin to have an alternative to war. And you can call for the abolition of war.
Okay. Let me ask a different kind of question. The document that you put together calls on its readers to, quote, develop alternatives in protecting the innocent, restraining aggressors, and overcoming injustice. And yet, we're not supposed to accept the Constantinian temptation of making sure that history comes out right by seizing the levers of conventional power. I'm interested to know what that does and doesn't entail in a world in which states don't go to war anymore. This country hasn't fought a declared war since 1945. Most of its imperial adventures in the last 230 years have been undeclared wars. And the wars, the violence, the invasions of your lifetime and my children's lifetime will be rescue missions, interventions of a humanitarian nature, the doctrine of the so-called responsibility to protect, all of a whole range of things that re-describe and recategorize the imposition of force in the name of mercy, in the name of protection. I think one of the problems in a lot of contemporary Christian ethical discussions about war and violence is they accept, for example, a too facile distinction between warfare and policing, that police actions, either domestically or writ large, are qualitatively and categorically different than the use of organized military actions. I think that's a historical point of substantial contention, and it's one I don't find persuasive. But what does it mean to work to develop alternatives to protect the innocent and so on when that language has already been co-opted by the same forces that invade, that destroy, that operate the machinery of empires large and small precisely with the same disposition in mind?
Well, first of all, let me begin by just making it clear that I take it that one of the decisive challenges to a commitment to nonviolence is that finally you, as someone committed to nonviolence, may have to watch the innocent suffer for your convictions. I don't think there's any way of avoiding that as a possibility, that you may have to watch the innocent suffer for your convictions. It doesn't mean that you want to have to watch the innocent suffer for your convictions. You want to avoid it in every way. But while I think that is nonetheless true for a commitment to nonviolence, I think it's true of any serious moral commitment, that you may have to watch innocent people suffer for that commitment. If you're a just warrior, if you're a just warrior, you should have been ready to invade the beaches of Japan rather than drop Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because that was murder. And so a just warrior would rather have more people die than to commit one murder. They're going to have to watch the innocent suffer for their convictions too. In that way, I agree with Mike. I think the language of humanitarian intervention is very dangerous language, and Philip Reeve's book, I can't remember the name of it, is a wonderful testimony to that. He was very committed to humanitarian intervention. And after seeing it, became very doubtful about whether you could control it. But I do want to disagree with Mike about, at least in principle, the difference between police power and war. Police power and the police function says that it's different than war because you only intervene as the police in terms of what the law allows. And so the police function separates the act of judgment, whether you're really guilty, from the act of prevention, that namely you have to intervene in a violent circumstance, but you're not making ultimate judgments at that point. Now, of course, if that is a, and that that makes it different than war, but that that is a distinction that is very hard to maintain in reality. And in that, I think Mike is probably right to worry about whether you can have a strong distinction between police function and the war function of the state. But it is, John Yoder was always ready to enter in to imaginative possibilities of asking, how would our lives need to be ordered that people could be called, Christians be called to the police function of the governing authorities in a manner that they didn't have to wear guns? I mean, wouldn't that be interesting? I mean, just start, rather than asking big questions about how do we make the world more just in terms of economic distribution, ask ourselves, what would it mean to be able to live in a community like Durham, North Carolina, in a manner that Christians might be called to the police function in a way they didn't have to wear guns?
They have those in the non-urban sectors of Alaska, for example. They're called village police officers, peace officers. Uh-huh. They're unarmed. They're generally overworked, overextended, and their status in the community is oftentimes a precarious matter. And everybody waits for the Alaska State Troopers to arrive when something serious happens. Right, David? Thank you. It's our expert on all things of the great White North up there. That's an interesting question, and I think that, you know, the separation of roles that you talk about, the protection function and the adjudication function, I understand that and I respect that. I think that historically that may be a more structural feature in liberal modernity than in other places, and I think it itself collapses under the militarization of domestic law enforcement in the U.S. and elsewhere.
Mike,
I've got three cops in my family, including a SWAT team commander. And I used to think they were the weird ones till I did the math and figured out that I was the one who didn't fit in the family. And I think as a community, I think the church is finally willing to entertain the question again about whether Christians in good conscience can serve in the armed forces. I think it's generally an act of timidity to not raise that question about whether they can serve in civilian police forces. Because in my family growing up, you didn't just see the police when your cat got lost or, you know, when a child wandered away from home. You saw them breaking strikes. You saw them protecting strike breakers. You saw a whole lot of other things that kind of in many ways illustrates the violence built into our notions of order. And to pretend otherwise in the interest of maintaining some of these distinctions, I think, ultimately stops us from asking questions that we need to ask one another. just so that we are telling the truth about what our vocation as Christians might invite us to contemplate. So, I mean, we don't have to go, you know, far down this path, but I think that particularly if it's the case that, as you mentioned, that a lot of these distinctions between war and peace are becoming effaced, distinctions between domestic and international as areas for the application of force in the name of order, there's a suburb about 20 miles south of Chicago that's hosting a military training exercise on Monday. It's a town called Tinley Park, Illinois. And it has a former State of Illinois facility that's a favorite for urban warfare training by the active military. This Monday, it's the Navy's turn to storm buildings and blow stuff up. The neighbors complained about the noise, so they're not using the helicopters this time. And I think that as we contemplate what the wars, or whatever we want to call them, of the future are going to be, I think we need to ask questions about our brothers and sisters who act in domestic order-keeping functions, what their vocation becomes in an era when these functions are increasingly transformed by the transformation of police training, local sheriff's departments, transfers of surplus military hardware, sharing of intelligence, joint task forces, which have proliferated into the hundreds, all of which, I think, make for interesting times in the future as the presumed safe space of domestic life becomes increasingly invaded by the tooth and claw that the U.S. uses in international politics.
Well, I think one, you ask, what can we do? I think one of the problems is when you're in a mixed crowd, that is, of people who are Christians, not Christians, so on, and you say, I'm committed to Christian nonviolence, that immediately puts people who have been in the military or have been in police work, it puts them on the defensive. And they think, well, I respect your position, but someone has to beat off the sons of bitches that otherwise would kill you. And therefore, I may not be doing what Jesus wants, but I'm doing what's necessary to let you feast in your self-righteous presumptions. And I think I'm not unsympathetic with that response, which means it makes all the difference in the world for us to be able to be in conversation with people that have been in the military, that have been called to police function, to say, what's that done to you? How can we be of help? Because it's not like, if you commit yourself to Christian nonviolence, it's not like you think that somehow you freed yourself from being complicit in the violences of the world, and that you, as a matter of fact, want to have that call, you want that name and to confess about it. And, I mean, we ask, I think one of the issues that obviously Mike has brought out so much in so much of his work is how important class considerations are about these matters. I mean, we ask people, so many people in the police function come from classes that are just above criminal classes, and we expect them to be to spend a lifetime being involved in domestic disputes, that when they get there, the two spouses turn on the police and beat the hell out of them, and this sort of thing. I mean, we need to say, it's not a question of I'm right and you're wrong. It's that we're equally caught in the powers in a manner that we need to help one another discover how we can be less determined by the assumed necessitation that when push comes to shove, the only way to survive is to kill someone. And how to do and be an alternative is that we say we won't use violence. I mean, that's a way to be committed to saying, well, there are imaginative possibilities that might exist if we're different.
You raise a point that I think ties in well with the ambition of the call for abolition. When you talk about how we have to explore the problem of language and the extent to which, as the church uncritically uses categories and terms that themselves legitimate the very things that we're encouraging a transformation for. I wonder if that doesn't invite, at least in the confines of a group like this, if it doesn't invite the proposition that we stop using the language of supporting the troops. I support John Smith, who is an Army reservist who comes back, or who's a friend of mine. I support, you know, Sally Anderson, who served one or two tours, has a life to deal with. As church, as Christians, as neighbors and friends, we can support people as individuals. But I wonder, and I'd like your thoughts on whether and to what extent the language and the trope of the supporting the role of troops as troops commits us to a whole range of assumptions and a whole range of ideological things that do real work that is in many ways opposed to what we're hoping to invite people to reconsider.
Well, I think that's right, that the language of supporting the troops can be very destructive. And why do we support the troops? Because, quote, they're making a sacrifice that our lives depend upon, allegedly. And I thought...
There's almost like an extreme Lutheran glorification of role and status that has to be fulfilled in the community,
yeah,
as a self-evident matter once we start using that terminology.
I, in the essay in War and the American Difference, Sacrifice and the Sacrifices of War, I try to get us off what I take to be the lack of any progress between just war and pacifist alternatives by hopefully very sympathetically, and I think it's genuine, appreciating what we ask of people in the military, not just the sacrifice of life and the life of their friends, but sacrificing their normal unwillingness to kill. And it takes such a training to get people to sacrifice their normal unwillingness to kill. Because most of we're not, God didn't create us to be killers. And so what, of course, what Nugent was saying yesterday about, you know, Christ is the end of sacrifice, and we don't want to ask you to sacrifice your unwillingness to kill. We don't want to ask you to sacrifice your life. The question then becomes, how does nonviolence become more interesting than war? Because war is so morally compelling. I mean, ask yourself, when was the last time you went to see a movie about peace? What would it look like? What would a movie about peace look like? It would look like Babette's Feast. How to have our imaginations captured by a movie like The Beck's Feast, in which it becomes an alternative to pietists who go to war because their lives are otherwise so damn boring. Those seem to me to be the kind of challenges before us of how do we, without dishonoring those in the military and the people that, partly I think, why do we have war? We have war because it's so deeply rooted in our imaginations as the greatest moral challenge before any human being. And that, therefore, we continue to sacrifice the youth of the present to show that the sacrifices of the youth of the past we're worthy of, just to the extent we continue to sacrifice the youth of the present. So exactly how we Christians can break into that moral logic, and it's a moral logic, to provide an alternative way of life that is demanding and therefore morally engaging as an alternative to war. Just calling for the abolition of war, I think, probably doesn't get to that deeper challenge.
If you take the idea of sacrifice that you've just raised, and I think usefully situate it as a matter of competing formations, the church is that body that is formed by the sacrifice of Christ, that is itself formed through the Eucharist, that creates a people, that is itself called to be given to the world, the sacrifice without repetition. And then look at, as you say, the notion of war as sacrifice. Could it be the case that one of the things as we move forward in trying to extricate ourselves from this sort of inevitability logic of war is to look at where that sacrifice is most glorified in our culture? For example, I think it's time that we start to name as idolatry the glorification of the so-called greatest generation. I think that the place that the Second World War holds in the American imagination needs to be rooted out. I think it's toxic. I think it's poisonous to the church. I think that it's the... One would recognize it in Russia when invocations of the great patriotic war are seen everywhere one turns to justify everything that Putin wants to do or that the Russian Orthodox Patriarch thinks is important to do. And yet, we are drenched in that war 70 years later ourselves. Films, games, music, you can't escape it. I bought a book at a chain bookstore by Tom Brokaw, one of these adulatory things about the World War II generation. And my receipt was an invitation to buy, let's see, The Greatest Generation Speaks, DVD, the movie, a couple of other films, the whole industry built around a particularly sanitized and ideologized picture of the great patriotic war. And I think that when you talk about the formative powers of imagination, the lifting that invocations of sacrifice do, it's not just the Republicans who play the World War II card to justify interventions and invasions and so on. Constitutional law teaching Nobel Peace Prize winning Illinois presidents play the card with equal enthusiasm. And how can we encourage people in the churches to get near something that is still a third rail, that is still a hot wire in congregations, even in those in which the number of extant members of the 1940s war are fewer and fewer and fewer?
How would you do that, Mike? I mean, I, of course, I agree that how to demythologize World War II as the Great War is something that clearly needs to be done. How do you do that without dishonoring those who participated often conscientiously? I mean, I think one of the problems of war is most people do not originally participate conscientiously. But how do you do that?
Well, I think one way to do it in a way that is perhaps properly respectful and prudent is to work backwards, is to start with, I mean, there's an old cliche that the worst thing about a legitimate war is all the illegitimate ones it sanctions for the next several generations. Start at the present and work backwards and, you know, try to identify those applications of lethal violence in one's own name and see how those have been coded with or sanctioned or protected by the rhetoric, the ideology, the mythology of the war against fascism and the war against Hitler and all the... I'm going to be 55 years old. I think I've lived through 7 new Hitlers in my life. From Saddam Hussein to Manuel Noriega to Ho Chi Minh, take
Osama
your point. Osama bin Laden. They're running out of guys, but he'll be back. He'll be back. I don't know what the next one will look like, but I think even as a way to move gradually and cautiously into those conversations, at a minimum, I think there are doors we could open to say, look at how this putatively noble sacrifice has been bastardized, trivialized, and then move backward.
One of the crucial questions there is, who is the we again?
I'm talking about the church. The culture will not have this conversation.
Right.
You will get yourself thrown out of, out of a mother's club talking about this.
Yana?
It's an excellent question. The question about Yana raised the question about the extent to which Nazism, correct me if I'm wrong, serves as a kind of an absolute evil, even among young people for whom that might as well have been, you know, the Russo-Japanese War for my generation. And the extent to which people in our culture exert considerable energy to say, well, we would never be like them. We would never be like the Germans, the German Nazis, the supporters of the Reich, when in fact, it's quite conceivable how that could happen, and maybe that's a point of exploration. And I agree completely. I think that, much of what it means to be church in a culture like ours is in cultivating the formation of affections, desires, dispositions, dreams, notions of the true, the good, and the beautiful that are alternate and different from that the culture puts on offer. And it's a competitive matter. To the extent that the story of America written by its wars and its sacrifices wins, the church loses. And I think, you know, the question always about what to do about the Germans always starts the conversation too late. It's after our brothers and sisters in Christ in Europe have been convinced that being a patriot and being a Christian are mutually supportive identities, and then chaos breaks loose. Then what do you do? Back it up. Back it up 400 years, and then let's have a conversation.
Yeah, just as a footnote, if you haven't ever looked at it, look at Buddy's great friend Brimlow's book, What About Hitler? It takes it straight on. When people ask me, what about the Nazis, I always say, who fought in Hitler's armies? They say, well, I guess, you know, SS and that kind of thing. Good Catholics and good Protestant Lutherans. I mean, one, you'll never get anywhere arguing about what if and when you get to the Nazis. But if just to say, all we're trying to do is to begin to form Christians to be able to locate a Hitler when they come along and to be able to say no. what are the conditions of being able to say no now? I'm not going to make judgments about who was and who wasn't right about World War II. The question is, what about now? Where are we now? How do we avoid that? And again, I mean, but the eschatological issues don't go away, because you're going, if you as Christians, as a people, are able to say no, they're going to discover that they live in a world where most people don't want to say no, and that's going to be in means that you're going to need one another desperately to sustain that. And that's what wasn't the case in Germany. The Catholics had more possibilities than Lutherans, who had the two kingdom view. But it was not easily discerned on either by either Christian tradition. Yeah, let's open up.
Let's open up for questions and comments more generally. I'll try to restate from the microphone. We'll start in the back, sir. Yes, go ahead.
Started to have her pastor along with Father Red, John Hardy, with
Very good. Very good. Thank you. If you've not had opportunity to look at Mark Twain's piece, The War Prayer, I encourage you to do it. It's a scathing piece of satire that he refused to publish under his own name during his lifetime for fear that it would cut into his livelihood. It was sufficiently provocative.
Since then, but one of the things that clearly has changed is that England is no longer the material recipient of the benefits of a
horrible,
brutal empire.
Right.
For the Kellogg-Briand Treaty of 1928, one of the issues that disturbs me a little bit is how quickly it's dismissed. In many ways, rightly so, but it's instructive that what happened between 1928 and, say, 1928 was that the signatories engaged in state violence without declaring war. So we declare war, they will therefore we're going to keep on doing what we're going to do, but not call it war. But on the other hand, during the Nuremberg trials, Kellogg-Briand was evoked as a way to say that what you guys did was illegal.
Such is the way of victor's justice, I think, in many respects. I bow to the superior geekdom of Dr. Volk, except that the law is really, I part company with some of my colleagues in some of the other related areas that we work in, that international law remains, I think, primarily the strictures of the powerful laid down for the less powerful. Humanitarian intervention and a responsibility to protect won't be anything other than legal ledger domain, unless somebody wants to invade Austin neighborhood in Chicago to stop the shootings. I mean, I don't expect to see that, and there's good reasons not to want to see that.
I had the is the movement from the Peelers to the Bobbies. I always, and it's still most of the Bobbies in London don't carry guns. There are designated trained people that are the only ones that are allowed to carry the gun. And most of the times they're locked up. The guns are before they get them out. I did years ago. I thought one of the things about the Bobbies is, of course, they look silly, and I think that look is not accidental to how they help intervene in a manner that diffuses certain kinds of violence. I remember years ago during Vietnam and the Democratic National Convention was here in Chicago when Hubert Humphrey was nominated, and there were these terrible confrontations between the Chicago police and people protesting the war and protesting the convention. And Mayor Daley had the Chicago police wearing the helmets with the visors, and they had gun belts across their chest and so on. And, I mean, they looked ready for trouble. And I got the idea at that time, and I was thinking of the Bobbies, We should have dressed the Chicago police up in clown uniforms and had them say, "What do you guys want?" You know, okay. The very way we lack imagination to say in terms of the way that you look like you're inviting violence by the way you dress the police. And I think there's a lot that we could imaginatively do. I mean, you feel like, I mean, the protester throwing stuff at a clown and saying, "Fascist bastard," I mean, you'd look pretty silly. I mean, "Fascist bastard," this is a guy that's kin to Mike Buddy just trying to get through life. So exactly how you diffuse the violence through a magic.
Thank you. Don't forget your waitresses, ladies and gentlemen. Family horror.
I was going to ask you for your views and thoughts about the military-industrial complex. And as a citizen, President Eisenhower, for those who are aware, gave a very profound exiting speech to the presidency about his beliefs that the military-industrial complex in the United States was going to be a big problem for a long time to come. And as a citizen of the United States, I feel it's difficult for me to make a drop in the ocean when a large part of our government is governed by the military-industrial complex, and their elections and our representatives who are representing us citizens and taking us to war and police actions. It's governed by this. We need to make more weapons. We need to keep people employed. This is how I keep my citizens in my town employed. And I just feel, what are your thoughts on how we can combat that? Because to me, that is a very big step in the abolition of war.
Yeah, I mean, basically, America is socialism for the military and capitalism for the poor. And I was thinking earlier that Mike and I hadn't really talked about the economic aspects of how it is that war is a part of the economic machine that drives so much of American life. And what it means then, nonviolence means you put a lot of people out of work. And how then do you envision an alternative to putting a lot of people out of work? It's hard to know where you would even begin. In that regard, if you remember, it was a number of years ago, one of the places that we put atomic weapons together is outside El Paso. And the Bishop of El Paso, because of the American bishop's letter on peace, worried about any Roman Catholic working in this
Annex. Amarillo.
It's Amarillo, thank you. And that was seen as a shot across the bow of the economics of the matter in a way that I much applauded, but he got into a lot of trouble. Do you have any suggestions about this?
No.
Well, I think the question you raise is really a crucial one. It would have been great if Eisenhower would have given that speech in 1950 instead of 1960. You know, on his way out the door, having largely built the military-industrial complex that he later found himself frightened by. Thanks, President Eisenhower.
It was also the highway system.
Oh, sure. The interstate highway system was passed because it was put forward as a national security measure in order to deploy troops across the country more quickly. You know, I think we should the United States spends more money on its military than the next 13 countries combined, year in and year out. There's a book by a guy named Paul Kennedy called The Rise and Decline of Nations, which made a bit of a splash about 25 or 30 years ago, that says basically the time in which international politics is often most unstable is when previously hegemonic powers go into economic decline. What they have left is an overbuilt military that redefines all the problems as military matters. The United States, as the preeminent economic power, has probably seen that day come and gone. It remains without peer the most effective and most efficient purveyor of military apparatus, structure, and violence worldwide. That's our comparative advantage in the world market. That's going to be here for a long time, and that's why, in some respects, so many problems of the next 30 years will be redefined as security matters, rather than as matters of trade, matters of sustainability. The military is redefining climate change as threats to national security and updating its contingency plans for domestic unrest in the event of hurricanes, tornadoes, disasters, snow. When all you've got's a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. And I think that that's, and the point you raise is that, you know, there are multiple reasons to suspect that the notion of permanent war is an endemic rather than lamentably partisan feature.
One of the things we haven't discussed is how smart people in the military are. I mean, they really look realistically at the world in which they live, and they try to make the best judgments they can about what their responsibilities are. And in that respect, the military knows today, for example, that they represent an ethic that is incompatible with bourgeois capitalism, since they are people of honor that know they have to keep their word if they are to be to be able to maintain the discipline necessary to sustain the loss of life and the sacrifice of life. And I think one of the things that is not discussed widely in the American public, but is discussed in the American military, is how do you sustain a military's ethic in a society that no longer underwrites that moral commitments. I was at the Air Force Academy a number of years ago. They asked me to come and give, you know, a pacifist view of just war, which I was glad to do there. And they have a philosophy department. And they teach just war. That's the thing they do. And I asked them if there was much discussion now of American warfighting strategy, which, and the drones were just beginning, namely of using massive firepower that means that you're able to kill the enemy without you yourself being exposed to being killed. And they said that it is a roaring discussion within the military, because most military people think it's dishonorable to kill if you're not willing to be killed. I mean, those are the kinds of discussions that I think we should be ready to enter into.
Deb?
I don't have any idea. But I'm that you can sit in Iron Mountain in Colorado and direct drones in Afghanistan and Iraq, and then go home to play with your two-year-old. It's bizarre, but it's real. And you kill someone that day. Do you know you have? Do you need to help people that do that know they have? I mean, those are big challenges.
One frustration I've heard from a lot of people is...
Hold on, I've been asked to... Mikey.
Oh, thanks. One frustration that I've heard in many conversations is that American advocates of nonviolence tend to focus a lot of their attention and analysis and regret and consideration on violence perpetrated by Americans and have relative silence about violence perpetrated by members of other nations. To what extent is it necessary that the church focuses its attention on what we are doing and what we have done? And does the church have a word to speak to and about the violence that is being done, has been done by other countries?
Oh, that's a great question. And I think that's one of the points of entry for re-emphasizing the small c Catholicity of the church. If in fact we take our baptism seriously, that in fact we are brothers and sisters in Christ, it's for those places in which there are other Christians abroad, it would be nice to be in a position to ask them, why are you contemplating putting your allegiance to your regime, your generals, your president, over the solidarity and support that you owe your brothers and sisters in Christ, as well as to everybody else in the human family? It's great to get to a point where you can raise those conversations. So no, it's not a one-sided proposition. I think it's cheap and ineffective to presume that, you know, vice resides only in the bosom of the most powerful. I think in many cases what restrains less powerful states is the fact that they're less powerful. You know, it's sometimes opportunity as well as motivation. But no, I think that, I mean, it's precisely the judgment of history later that those questions don't get asked of one another within the churches. Why is World War I called a war, to answer Stanley's question, and not, you know, a complete collapse of solidarity among Christians? Why were the wars in Central America in the 1980s described the way they were, rather than as the capitulation of Christians in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, to something other than their baptismal vows? So it's a good point you raised, and I'm glad you did.
There's also the issue, Russell, which is, I think, implied in your question, of nonviolence is a possibility for those of us well off and well defended. What about people who have been suffering oppression for many years, who are poor, and the only alternative seems to be you got to kill the bastard? I take that to be a powerful critique, and the only thing to say is that the problem of using violence to get the bastard off your neck is the bastard still is overdetermining you, exactly to the extent that you have to employ exactly the bastard's violence to, as part of your life, and
that's a great debate to have.
It's a great debate.
You know, that's the debate that Ernesto Cardinal had with
right.
Daniel Berrigan in the late 1970s. Cardinal was a priest in Nicaragua who joined the revolution, ultimately became a cabinet minister, and who was challenged by his friend Daniel Berrigan, the American Jesuit, the anti-Vietnam War activist, precisely on the question of whether in defense of the poor you should take up arms. And they had a great principled dispute on that point. What made it something other than a sham was the fact that Dan Berrigan at the time was among the few people who could say, my commitment to nonviolence has cost me. This isn't just cheap grace. This isn't just North American grandstanding. But it's a debate that, God, we would love to have that, wouldn't we?
Absolutely. And I take it Yoder's response is that the problem with violence used in the name of liberation of the poor is it's still trapping you in the powerlessness of the necessity of violence, and you look for imaginative ways. I mean, people appeal to Martin Luther King, of course, I mean, all the time as an alternative, but he's susceptible to the same critique that this was still used within nonviolence was possible because you had the economic and moral resources for it, where so many people don't. But exactly, I mean, the alternative is Gandhi. I mean, Gandhi really was an extraordinarily politically smart guy. And I think he continues to deserve close study about what he was about. I think it's not accidental that Bonhoeffer constantly wanted to go to India, because he saw what was coming, and he thought he had to have something like a Gandhian alternative. But he didn't have. And that's what, you know, you want a people to somehow envision.
Possibly our last question.
I want to kind of press on and maybe challenge the notion of the end of sacrifice. And the reason I want to do that, I'm thinking particularly lately about what Sarah Coakley has been doing in terms of conversation with evolutionary biology and other areas. But the Pauline writings call us to be a living sacrifice. And we're called, at least in strains of Anglican and Roman Catholic theology, to be participants in the sacrifice of Christ. But the logic is death and resurrection. And the reason I want to challenge that notion, I guess I want to hear nuance, because my sense is that we will sacrifice no matter what, but what are we sacrificing for, to what end?
Let me see if I can find it. Augustine, I'm looking for it. I have too many footnotes. Augustine says exactly that. But we participate in the sacrifice of Christ, which is the end of all sacrifices. Augustine says, I can't find the quote, in the City of God, that justice cannot exist where that sacrifice is not the center of your life. And I think that's right. But it's not that we continue to sacrifice because Christ's sacrifice was not sufficient. We become part of the sacrifice because Christ's sacrifice was sufficient. And we don't therefore have to continue to make sacrifices to God to show, as a matter of fact, that our lives can still have, that God hasn't done everything that needs to be done. So that that is the reference to the end of sacrifice, That is at once why the end of sacrifice is the glorification of God, and why sacrifices have ended with Christ's cross, of which we then participate in.
The way we talk about military-industrial complex and the military generically doesn't do justice to the language behind it. And I'm concerned. Richard Hayes and Nigel Bigger had an exchange in the Studies of Christian Ethics that assumed the military meant one thing, and we could say that it meant one thing. Everybody knows what we're talking about when we talk about it. And then within the last year, there was two terrorists who attacked a British soldier because, you know, he had gone over there and he had done something. Seems to me to be a similar homogenization. That seems all too similar to what happens when we think we all know what we're talking about when we say the gays or the blacks. So what can the church do to increase or to do justice to the complexity that is the people that constitute the military?
Well, that's a big question. I think one place to start is to re-examine the way that the churches understand the role of chaplains in the armed forces. I think that the long history of churches providing spiritual care, pastoral care to people in the military is an honorable thing in many respects. It's one that's particularly vulnerable to co-optation and evisceration. Not every country provides spiritual care to members of the armed forces by making clergy officers and going through military training and taking a loyalty oath to the armed forces as a precondition for their serving as chaplains. Not every way that one could imagine spiritual care provided to members of the armed forces and their families would require or... There are at least possibilities to envision ways in which that could be done by the churches as real vibrant congregations and not as self-justifying enclaves within the roles, expectations, and ethos of the armed forces themselves. That's a problem in all forms of chaplaincy, whether it's corporate chaplaincy, whether it's hospital chaplaincies, and so on, the extent to which the pastors become captured by the role that they serve. And I think that as a starting point, that's one that's long overdue in an American context.
Logan, I think the answer is partly we just need to hear from people that have been in the military and be really in conversation with them in a way that shows it's not you're a bad guy and we're a good guy, but we're caught. I found the Augustine quote, and I'm going to read it because it's a good way to end. It is we ourselves, we his city, who are his best, his most glorious sacrifice. The mystic symbol of this sacrifice is celebrated in our oblations, familiar to the faithful. It follows that justice is found for God, the one supreme God, rules an obedient city according to his grace, forbidding sacrifice to any being save himself alone, and where in consequence the soul rules the body and all who belong to the city and obey God, and reason faithfully rules devices in a lawful system of subordination, so that just as the individual righteous man lives on the basis of faith, which is active in love, so the association of people of righteous men live on the same basis of faith, active in love. The love with which a man loves God as God ought to be loved and loves his neighbor as himself. But where this justice does not exist, there is certainly no association of men united by a common sense of right or by a community of interest. Therefore, there is no commonwealth, for where there is no people, there's no weal of the people. I think war is the way to try to make a people where there is not the appropriate sacrifice of God. Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.